Islamic Revolution praises the country's armed forces for their performance during the recent anti-Israel operation. Israel's deadly campaign claims the lives of another 18 Palestinians in the city of Rafah as a new mass grave containing the bodies of 50 people is discovered in Khan Yunis. And the U.S. President signs into law a bill that extends the government's warrantless spying powers for 2 more years. Rights groups decry it as a historic mark of shame. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has praised the armed forces for their performance in the recent incidents. In a meeting with top military brass, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that the armed forces put on display a good image of their capabilities and power. The leader was referring to the massive missile and drone strikes on Israel after the regime's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the punitive operation by Tehran was a demonstration and proof of the will of the Iranian nation of the armed forces on an international stage. He stressed that the armed forces should continue their work to counter enemies by using innovative approaches. Now, after Iran successfully launched retaliatory attacks on Israel with hundreds of drones and missiles breaking through the regime's multi-layer air defense, Israel promised to take revenge. Our explainer program goes into detail on how Tel Aviv failed to materialize the threats.
This is Israel's first major threat against the Islamic Republic after Iran's extremely successful operation, True Promise. Israel has threatened to target Iran's nuclear facilities. How serious is Israel's threat, and has it taken into consideration what Iran is capable of doing militarily if it makes such a fatal decision? Well, after Iran's successful operation, True Promise, Israel has come out on many occasions promising that it would retaliate. This was even after the U.S. warned Israel that it would not support it, even if it carried out an attack on Iran. The extent of the threat ended there, especially since many days had passed. Iran, in response, had said that it would retaliate 10 times worse than Operation True Promise. Well, Operation True Promise was so successful that even some notable Israeli officials acknowledged Iran's military might. The former head of the Israeli Air Force had it said Iran is a superpower in tactical ballistic missiles and UAVs. Well, it's a well-known fact that Iran has the largest arsenal of ballistic missiles in the region, which some estimates place at around 3,000, a figure that could be a lot higher. Then comes this alleged attack by the Israeli regime, which involved what was said to be 3 quadcopters. It was so lame that Israel's national security official in a post on X used one word to actually describe the alleged response: weak. Iranian media responded, and they said the Israeli authorities are mocking themselves. Then comes Israel's threat to target Iran's nuclear facilities, clearly against international law. Nuclear power plants are civilian objects. Not that it has not issued this kind of threat before, but this comes after Operation True Promise. The military landscape has changed. Israel is wounded from Operation True Promise, feeling the wrath of Iran's over 350 missiles and drones. Now, in response, Iran has announced that it could review its nuclear doctrine and deviate from the previous reservations. This does not necessarily mean that Iran is after nuclear bombs. I mean, let's not forget, in 2003, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued a fatwa that forbade the production and using any form of weapons of mass destruction. Iran also stated that the nuclear centers of the Zionist enemy have been identified, and the necessary information is at Iran's disposal, with our hands on the trigger, as Iran has said. The Israeli regime's era of hit and run is over. Like attacking Syria repeatedly, assassinating Iran's military advisors, and terrorist acts against Iran's nuclear industry and scientists, Iran has stated its military doctrine has changed and that it will actually target Israel from Iranian territory, directly from its soil, if any of its assets or personnel are targeted. But the era of double standards is not over. Israel has murdered over 14,000 children, killed journalists, attacked hospitals, shot civilians holding up white flags, bombed ambulances, used starvation as a weapon of war, attacked the consulate building. Well, the list is rather long. Yet the EU and the U.S. come out and said, we have decided to sanction Iran.
Now moving on, the Israeli military keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with air raids and artillery fire, killing more civilians. One of the latest attacks at the southern city of Rafah, where the regime has carried out a strike almost on a daily basis. The overnight bombing killed at least 18 people, almost all of them children. Several Palestinians were also killed in Jabalia and Nusayra refugee camps. Since October 7th, more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli attacks, most of them women and children. The true figure is likely much higher as thousands remain buried under the rubble. On Saturday, Palestinian Civil Defense said bodies of 50 people buried by Israel in a mass grave were recovered inside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Our correspondent Motiebe Musabe joined us from the city of Darabella earlier with details regarding the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip.
And in a continuation of the Israeli crimes, the Israeli warplanes carried out several air strikes against multiple areas of Gaza Strip, basically in Rafah City, whereas at least 15 Palestinian civilians, including 13 Palestinian children, were reportedly killed by the Israeli occupation forces after they were attacked inside their houses, which were subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli relentless air strikes. It's worth mentioning that Rafah City has been under heavy bombardments for roughly two consecutive weeks. Every day, at least 3 to 4 horizontal buildings being destroyed by the Israeli warplanes. This escalation actually is seen by the Palestinian people, basically in Rafah City, as a preload to conduct the ground offensive. Because, as you know, it is known for any area to be subjected to a ground offensive to be attacked heavily by the Israeli warplanes and the artillery shelling. And here in the central area of Gaza Strip, basically the northern part of Nusayrat refugee camp, it also was subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli artillery shelling that was maintained all the night. And here in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah City, it was also hit relentlessly and continuously by the Israeli artillery shelling. Massive explosions were heard over the last night here, in addition to continuous and multiple Israeli airstrikes that hit the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital.
Now, meanwhile, Israeli forces have shot dead 2 more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank as the regime continues with crackdown there. Now, that took place at the entrance of the village of Beit Einun near the southern city of Al-Khalil. IOF then stormed the village and raided several Palestinian homes. The Israeli army claims that one of the Palestinians tried to stab a soldier while the other opened fire at the regime's forces. Now, this after Israeli troops killed 14 people in the Nur al-Shams refugee camp in a raid which began on Thursday. Since the beginning of the onslaught on Gaza, Israel has carried out near daily raids in the West Bank. Some 500 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks so far. Correspondent Mona Kendall joined us earlier from Ramallah with details of the Israeli crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
The Israeli military declared this morning that 2 Palestinians arrived at the Beit Einun intersection. It's northeast Al-Khalil at the entrance of the Palestinian village of Beit Einun. One Palestinian had a gun. He opened fire at the Israeli soldiers there, and the other Palestinian had a knife and he was running towards the Israeli forces to stab them. However, the Israeli troops at the scene immediately opened fire at the 2 Palestinians and they neutralized them. This means that they opened fire, shot and killed them. This is what the Israeli military is saying. The Israeli military is also saying that none of the Israeli forces had been wounded. The identity of those 2 Palestinians is still unknown. The Israeli forces have confiscated the body, and they themselves who informed the Palestinians that the 2 Palestinians who arrived at the Beit Einun intersection tried to stab and to open fire at Israeli soldiers to carry out an anti-Israeli operation. They were shot and killed. However, they did not reveal about their identity. Today, Sunday, there's a general strike and a state of mourning had been declared here in the occupied West Bank to mourn the killing of at least 14 Palestinians were shot and killed by the Israeli forces in Tul Kerem, in Nur Shams, a refugee camp, an operation that lasted for almost 3 days since Thursday.
Now, tensions running high between Lebanese resistant movement Hezbollah and Israel in southern Lebanon. On Sunday, Hezbollah targeted buildings used by Israeli forces in the settlement of Shomera. Our correspondent in Lebanon, Mayim Saleh, tells us more.
Now we know that they have targeted two residents that are being used by Israeli soldiers in the settlement of Shomera. Now, Shomera is considered by the Lebanese government a Lebanese town, the town of Tarbiha. So it is one of seven Lebanese towns that are considered Lebanese-occupied territory. Yesterday we saw them also target another area, which is the town of Salha. We also have another operation for the resistance where they targeted espionage and technological devices in the barracks of Dubiv. Seems that Hezbollah is also very much alert on when the Israelis do plant the devices and that therefore they target them. And this is also a part of the long war. This is definitely a war where you have the intelligence element and the factor of the intelligence issue very significant. And when the Israelis were blinded at the border, they needed to use other instances and devices. They also had the issue of the Meron Bay base, they needed to use that also to get intelligence. Hezbollah made it clear that they also targeted that base as well because they, of course, in retaliation for the heavy striking deep in the heart of Lebanon, but also to tell the Israelis that they have the ability to be able to target their devices and their basically their frequencies and all their attempts to get intelligence from Lebanon.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's carried out a fresh drone strike against Israeli positions in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. The Iraqi movement says it hit a vital target in the occupied heights. The attack was in response to massacres committed by the Israeli regime against Palestinian civilians, including women and children. The group says it will continue the operations against Israeli targets. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has conducted a series of attacks against Israeli positions. It's also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Iraqi resistance movement Hezbollah al-Nujaba has held a seminar in Baghdad. This after a deadly air raid on a military base belonging to the resistance fighters in the Iraqi capital. We've talked to some of the participants of the seminar about the attack.
In one way or another, the Zionist regime and the U.S. are responsible for this attack. Whether it's agreed upon or not, it clearly aims to weaken our anti-terror forces by targeting the popular mobilization forces, which is a shameful act. The PMF is a national security force, and attacking such entities following our Prime Minister's visit to Washington is dishonorable.
Definitely, there's collaboration between the Zionist entity and the U.S. It's said that the attack was carried out by the Zionist army, but we know that it happened with the help of the U.S., since it has military bases in Iraq. Thus, Washington is responsible for facilitating the Israeli attack on the PMU. The U.S. plans to postpone its withdrawal from the Iraqi soil, and that is why it denies any involvement in the attack.
The goals of the attack were a bit vague for any party that seeks to respond. The U.S. denied that it had carried out any attack in Iraq, and some sources say it was carried out by international coalition forces, while some data shows that Israel is responsible. So until now, it is unclear, and thank God, it was a failure for whoever was trying to target the resistance forces.
The attack was another violation of Iraqi sovereignty and airspace in a series of violations that we have witnessed, which targeted our security forces and resistance without any justification. We believe that the reason America and its allies keep targeting our resistance is that they have deep fears of our forces.
America's denial of carrying out the attack doesn't necessarily mean that it was not involved. We all know that the U.S. collaborates with the Israeli regime, which now tries to attack the resistance front in an attempt to achieve its malicious goals in the West Asia region.
The U.S. president has signed into law a bill that extends the government's warrantless spying powers for 2 years. Joe Biden signed Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act after it passed by Senate by 60 against 34 votes. The move was a slam by privacy advocates inside and outside Congress. They said it allows intelligence agencies to spy on the communications of non-U.S. citizens, including communications and such service providers as Google. The activist group Demand Progress says that the law is a dangerous tool at the hands of any president and a historic mark of shame. The Brennan Center for Justice also said the law is shameful and a gift to any president who would wish to spy on political enemies, journalists, and ideological opponents. The political commentator Kevin Barrett tells us how the extension of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act impinges on liberties enshrined in the U.S. Constitution.
The government of the United States today, which is really an illegal and unconstitutional regime that's usurped the American Republic, has every reason to be paranoid. Because, again, they're completely illegal. They have no legitimacy. And the reason they have no legitimacy is precisely that they have overthrown the United States constitutional republic and replaced it with a kind of imperial, militarized, corporate fascist regime. The United States Constitution very clearly bans, quote-unquote, unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. That's always been interpreted as demanding that the authorities get a specific search warrant for any kind of surveillance of anybody in the United States before actually collecting any information. And that search warrant has to be asked for from a judge. The judge has to verify the specifics of the individual case before the government is allowed to spy. There has to be probable cause that a crime has been committed. Otherwise, the United States government, if it were a legitimate constitutional government, would not be allowed to spy on anyone without each of those specific warrants. That's the way the law has always been interpreted in the United States.
And the report brings to the end of this newscast.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Our friends in the negotiating team are aware of our viewpoints. We have discussed the details, those that I'm concerned about, with them. Of course, there are many details that I do not get involved in. We are after reaching an agreement. If someone says that there is a person among the officials of the Islamic Republic who is not after reaching an agreement, they have said a wrong thing. Everyone should know this. All the officials of the Islamic Republic, me, the administration, the Majlis, the judiciary branch, different security and military organizations and the like share the view that an agreement should be reached. Everyone also shares the view that this agreement should be an honorable one and that the interests of the Islamic Republic should be considered in a careful and scrupulous way. There is no disagreement about this. I, the administration, the Majlis, and every other organization and person share these beliefs and opinions.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The agreement should be a fair agreement, one that ensures the interests of the Islamic Republic. I should add that we are after the lifting of sanctions. Our purpose of entering into the nuclear negotiations is to lift sanctions. We are seriously pursuing the goal of lifting sanctions, but at the same time, we consider sanctions as an opportunity. It should not be the case that some people express surprise at the idea of sanctions as an opportunity. They might say, "How can sanctions, such a bad thing, be an opportunity? Sanctions made us rely on ourselves. They made us think about our inner capabilities and the pursuit of domestic capacities. That we import everything with oil earnings is the most dreadful disaster and the problem for a country like ours. Unfortunately, this problem has been haunting our country since the pre-revolutionary era, and it is continuing in a very serious way. We should put an end to this. We pursued domestic capacities in the area of science, technology, and different other areas. By Allah's favor, we should do the same in the area of the economy." These were our statements about the nuclear issue.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Farewell to the arms. The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But sometime later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Dac Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. 6 months passed since the final declaration of the United Nations, but normalcy had yet to be restored to the cities. The people of Palestine did not want to come to terms with the injustice. Everyone knew that the war was looming. People in Deir Yassin were seeing the migrant Jews in their neighborhoods. They didn't want to be the initiators of war. They were preparing for a new harvest season. But the sun had just risen when 120 Israeli armed men surrounded the village. The people of Deir Yassin faced what they had feared most. Deir Yassin was the first place to burn in the flames of war. The stench of major atrocity filled the air in Palestine. The Israelis killed more than 250 civilians, including women and children, and over 100 children were left orphans. Other cities and villages face Deir Yassin's fate, one after the other. Palestinian men sent their families to safer cities and took up arms to defend their homeland. After a few months of popular resistance, the armies of Arab nations rushed to the Palestinian people's rescue, which led to the first Arab-Israeli war. A year later, Israelis were the winners of the war. The 65,000 strong army that had come from seven Arab states to help the Palestinians could not do much. They were less than half the Israeli forces in numbers. On the other hand, the Israelis' newly purchased equipment, compared to the Palestinians' old and dilapidated equipment, made many people disappointed. The immigrant Jews, who had only purchased only 2% of Palestine's land from the British, were now occupying 70% of the land. The war claimed the lives of 25,000 people and left 700,000 Palestinians homeless and displaced. They migrated to neighboring countries. People lived cold and grim lives away from home. Their only hope was to return to their homes one day. After a few years, a new ray of hope shines for the Palestinians. This time from the West, a man came to power in Egypt. People are infatuated with his ideas. His words smell like freedom. Gamal Abdel Nasser's ideas are an inspiration for nations seeking independence. He sought to revive the pride of Arab nations. He forced thousands of European troops who've been occupying Egypt for decades to pack up and leave for Britain. The people were filled with joy. Gamal had an idea. He wants to unite Arab nations so they can gain independence together. But there's a major obstacle in his path.
About the rights of the Arabs of Palestine were expelled out of their country. We have about 1.5 million refugees. They treated the Arabs the same way. Expelled them, killed their children, destroyed their villages, and there was escape from Palestine to the Arab country. The Arabs of Palestine want to return back to their homeland.
The Israeli army decided to conquer the entire Middle East. Their military equipment is made up of the most modern French warships and warplanes, and the United States is also beefing up their military by handing them more than $60 million in military aid each year. But worst of all was the news of atomic weapons being produced in Israel's nuclear sites. It meant that the Israelis were not going to give up so easily. Gamal had initiated various projects to empower Egypt on par with Israel and was now holding war games so he can flaunt his country's military might to world leaders. The flames of the war would either burn Israel or it would shatter Gamal's dreams. 10 tensions were on the rise along the borders. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. The Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As a next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. Gamal's nightmare came true. Israel strikes preemptively and turns the tide in its own favor. Israeli jets destroyed more than 400 Egyptian aircraft and their hangars. The Jordanian army orders a counter-strike in revenge, but the Jordanian fighter jets disappear from radar screens one after the next. The outcome of the battle on the ground was not so different from the one in the air. Once again, people had to flee in order to save their own lives. Israel only needed 6 days to grab enough land to make itself 3 times larger. Syria's Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, the Sinai Desert in Egypt, and all of Palestine up to the River Jordan were occupied by Israel. Other Arab nations ended up with the same fate as the Palestinians had. Now half the population of Palestine had to live under Israeli occupation. It seems they had to give up their struggle for freedom. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of 2 Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. But they were ambushed and surrounded from behind. They were trapped and in the first few hours suffered over 100 casualties. Israeli forces received a lethal blow, so they retreated. The Jordanian artillery also rushed to the rescue of Fatah and struck the retreating Israeli forces. Now, all that remained from the so-called invincible army was a few abandoned, burned-out tanks. Fatah broke the myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army. The leader of their group was one of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who did something astounding to achieve his goals. The man who always had a smile on his face and would never give up. In August 1929, the sixth child of the Arafat family was born. His father named him Mohammed Yasser, meaning the bringer of relief, to give hope to the family in hardships. His Palestinian family had migrated from Al-Quds to Egypt a few years back, but the hard times came to him sooner than he expected. He lost his mother when he was just 4 years old and laid her to rest. And his father had to send him to live with his uncle in Al-Quds. Yasser witnesses the conflict between Palestinian freedom fighters and British forces in Al-Quds up close and personal. After a while, he goes back to Cairo to study. His first year at the university coincides with the hard days for Palestine and the start of the first Arab-Israeli war. He joined the Arab nations' army to go fight for Palestine. However, after a year, they suffered a defeat and he thought he should perhaps pursue his studies. He applies for a visa to study at the University of Texas in the U.S. It took a few months for his request to be processed. Yasser, meanwhile, changed his mind and decided to stay and fight to return to his homeland. At first, he held discussions and forums about Palestine. In one of these discussions, he revealed his plans. He asserted that armed resistance was the only way to save Palestine and founded the Fatah movement. He planned a series of operations, but everything should have been done secretly. But the second defeat for the Arab nations was a heavy blow for him. This time around, he planned an operation in the heart of Tel Aviv and immediately claimed responsibility for it. when he was asked to retreat, he responded, "The Palestinian people have always been fleeing, but this time we are going to resist, even if it costs us our lives." Only 48 hours after Arafat's victory, 5,000 people asked to join the Fatah movement. Arafat's popularity grew by the day, so Israelis decided to immediately take him out. Arafat became so popular that everyone called him leader of the Palestinian nation. They said, "He's come to shine the ray of hope in the heart of the Palestinian nation." Fatah grew bigger and bigger by the day. After a year, the Arab nations recognized Fatah as the only official Palestinian organization. Gamal, as the most important Arab leader, also backed it. The Fatah movement's successes aroused the Jordanian king's jealousy. And in no time, a conflict started between Fatah and the Jordanian army. Gamal acted as a mediator and asked both sides to stop fighting. Arafat agreed, but the next day, Gamal said farewell to life after a heart attack, and Arafat, who had just set out in this path, lost his important supporter. Arafat was forced to relocate the Fatah movement's headquarters. Lebanon was the first destination that Arafat chose to continue his fight against Israel. Although he had many opponents in Lebanon, his backers give him and this cause all-out support. Yet Arafat did not believe that Lebanon's support for the liberation of Palestine was enough. Arafat's trips around the world made headline news. He embarked on trips from Asia to Africa and from Africa to Europe to find new supporters. Only a few days after victory of the Iranian Revolution, he traveled to Iran and the first Palestinian embassy was established in Tehran in his presence. People in occupied Palestinian territories knew Arafat very well. He wanted to get the world on board in order to wrest back the occupied Palestinian territories and soon got what he was looking for. He traveled to New York and for the first time, a Palestinian speaks about Palestine to world leaders for an hour. And everyone gave him a standing ovation. Everyone but one group.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. So welcome to this episode of Lantern, in which in every program we have a nice story, of course. We learned many things from that short story, inshallah. The title of today's story is Lesson from a Butterfly. One day a small opening appeared in a cocoon. A man sat and watched for the butterfly for several hours as it struggled to force its body through that little hole. Then it seems to stop making any progress. It appeared as if it had gotten as far as it could, and it could not go any further. So the man decided to help the butterfly. He took a pair of scissors and opened the cocoon. The butterfly then emerged easily, but it had a withered body. It was tiny and shriveled wings. The man continued to watch because he expected that at any moment the wings would open, enlarge and expand to be able to support the butterfly's body and become firm. Neither happened. In fact, the butterfly spent the rest of its life crawling around with a withered body and shriveled wings. It never was able to fly. What the man in his kindness and his goodwill did not understand was that the restricting cocoon and the struggle required for the butterfly to get through the tiny opening were Allah's way of forcing fluid from the body of the butterfly into its wings so that it would be ready for flight once it achieved its freedom from the cocoon. Sometimes, struggles are exactly what we need in our life. If God allows us to go through our life without any obstacles, it would cripple us. We would not be as strong as we could have been, never been able to fly. I ask for strength, and God gave me difficulties to make me strong. I ask for wisdom, and Allah gave me problems to solve. I ask for prosperity, and Allah gave me a brain and brawn to work. I ask for courage, and Allah gave me obstacles to overcome. I ask for love, and Allah gave me troubled people to help. I ask for favors, and Allah gave me opportunities. I received nothing I wanted, but I received everything I needed. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to ponder about them and take some lessons and themes out of these stories in order to make use of them in our daily lives as Muslims. Well, today we want to talk about the difficulties and hardship that may occur to every one of us in this life. It is sometimes wrongly assumed that a person experiences hardship due to his or her own immorality or irresponsibility. Indeed, suffering is a tool for the forgiveness of our sins and might be a sign of God's love for a person. In this way, when people see someone suffering, they assume that person to be responsible, a view commonly seen throughout the history. However, we might not know that it is more complicated than this. The point is that when we consider the faithful, everyone would suffer according to the level of their faith and the amount of good deeds that they perform. So, if their iman or faith is stronger and they have more good deeds, they would suffer more. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also says,
Truly God has some servants on the earth who are very pure and dedicated to Him. Nothing good comes from the heaven to the earth except that God sends it away from them, and no calamity comes except that God sends it to them. This hadith tells us the rank that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give to those of His servants who suffer from hardship and difficulties in this world. Another aspect of viewing the hardship in this life is the strength that dealing with problems gives the person. It is only through suffering and difficulties that one can attain true happiness and prosperity. The Holy Book of Quran says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا فَإِذَا فَرَغْتَ فَانْصَبْ وَإِلَى رَبِّكَ فَارْغَبْ. But lo, with hardship goes ease. Lo, with hardship goes ease. So, when you are relieved, still toil and strive to please your Lord. You see in this verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that this life is in fact a mixture of good and bad, and we must not be disappointed when confronting difficulties. Okay, now let's go have a short break and we will be back in no time.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Lantern, and we are talking about the problems that happen to the lives of every person, including Muslims, and the way we are supposed to view these problems. Well, human attributes are evolved and made in the battlefield and riot of the world, and one can reach high perfection only through hardship, responsibility, and distress. You know, life is not for satisfaction, but for evolution. Ali ibn Abi Talib, Imam Ali alayhi salam, said in one of his famous letters to Uthman ibn Hanif, his governor in Basra, that living in comfort and delicateness and avoidance of difficulties ends in weakness and debility. And on the contrary, living in rough conditions makes a mole powerful and transfers ill's existential essence towards refinement. He also approaches him in the letter for having had a dinner with the rich who had allowed no poor for the evening. He then gives the example of trees in forests and gardens. Although contrast care is taken of garden trees, yet the deprived tree of the forest has a better quality. This is why when God is kind to somebody, He inflicts him or her with difficulty and suffering. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam said, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps his believer and sends him hardship like presents which a man sends for his family. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves his slave, He drowns him in the sea of suffering. So, if we want to attain true happiness, we have to go through all the difficult stages. Great men, in fact, suffered from torture, poverty, imprisonment, deprivation, and even death, and that is why they become great. We will end this episode with a sentence by Mullah Sadra. If there was no opposition or contradiction in existence, the continuance of benefit from the merciful God would not have been possible. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. And we have no more time to continue. I really wish that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
The Israeli occupation and killings of journalists. Freedom of media in the Palestinian territories is still closely related and influenced by the Israeli occupation and settlers, and their continuous violations against Palestinian journalists and media institutions. Being a journalist, regardless of nationality, is a job that is full of dangers and obstacles. It is also the job of truth seekers. The Palestinian journalist is destined to live within the walls of these violations. But despite these hard conditions, he or she still has determination, boldness, persistence, and strength.
The reality is that Palestinian journalists have a double suffering. On one hand, they are part of the Palestinian people who are subject to crimes and violations that qualify to genocide and war crimes. On the other hand, they have a dangerous job, especially in this hard environment under which Palestinians live because of the occupation. The Gaza Strip is besieged, while in the West Bank there is the apartheid wall, settlements, Judaization of Jerusalem, frequent violations and arrests. This affects the entire Palestinian society, and especially the journalists, as the occupation wants to black out the truth and their violations of human rights, as well as the state terrorism it practices. The Israeli occupation practiced all sorts of humiliation and subjugation methods on journalists. But along the years, the Palestinian journalist refused becoming a tool in the hands of the occupation and Israeli intelligence. And this made journalists sacrifice a lot. The Palestinian journalist plays a role as significant as that of the Palestinian politician or the fighter. To each his role. We have always seen the Palestinian journalist in the field. He would use his cameras and other tools to perform heroic and honorable achievements. He would always document and publicize the suffering of the Palestinian people, especially in the besieged Gaza Strip. He would always show the world the suffering, the incursions, the killing and torture Palestinians suffer on the hands of the Israeli occupation.
This boldness made the Israeli occupation army not differentiate between a journalist and another. So, everyone is targeted and everyone is wanted.
Regardless of their nationality, journalists pursue finding the truth, removing injustice, and unveiling crimes of the occupation, no matter who that occupation may be. We have seen examples for that where reporters for networks in the United States and Europe expose crimes committed by the U.S. and other countries. An exception to this is the few journalists who are affiliated with their government, no matter who that government may be. Such journalists have a questionable credibility and are renounced in their communities. Journalists who come to Palestine are our colleagues and friends. We have to help them, and the Israeli occupation has to respect their freedom of movement and work, like it respects our freedom. But unfortunately, the Israeli occupation, as you know, does not respect any kind of freedom, and it continues its violations against these journalists.
وتعتدي على هؤلاء الصحفيين.
الإسرائيلي لا يفرق بين صحفي فلسطيني.
The Israeli occupation does not differentiate between a Palestinian and a non-Palestinian journalist. The non-Palestinian journalist tries to document the events as they are. So the Israeli occupation relentlessly targets them and any other journalist who tries to document events on the ground without discrimination.
بدون أي تمييز ما بين